9. I'll read step 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step 9. You can all join in if you want to help out. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Our first panelist is Chris N. from Solid Foundations, Littleton, Colorado. Please help me welcome Chris.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chris. Say I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, but that's not always true, and I try not to lie from behind the podium. I did come into Al-Anon April 8th of 1994. Thank you. And the reason I know that date specifically was because I was able to look back months later, and when my girlfriend and I had come in together, apparently we couldn't sign our own names, so we'd signed for each other, which is a pretty good indication of how I was operating before I got here. I also haven't found it necessary to drink or take any mind-altering chemicals since a Hootie concert in the fall of 94. I don't remember the exact date, but I do have the t-shirt still. So I've been doing this deal a while, and you know, the toughest part I have about getting up here is to not tell you what I want to tell you, because there's a lot of things you need to know, and you know, tell you what my experience has been and let God speak through me. So what I'll do is just try and stay focused on the eighth and ninth step. The first time I was working on my list, I had a friend ask me, because I'd been working on the list for a while, how long is your list? And my response was, well, I've known a lot of people. And I said that flippantly. I didn't realize what that really meant. And what it really meant was that when I got here, I believed that if you'd been present in my life, I'd harmed you in some way because I wasn't worthy of being anywhere or in anybody's presence. If I had taken up oxygen that you were more rightly deserving of, I had harmed you. I don't feel that way anymore. That's one of the gifts of having made that list and going over that list with the help of a sponsor. A lot of help of a sponsor, because I owed everybody everything when I got here. We'll talk about my ninth step. Of course, as I'm going through the list, and you know, you divide it up into who you're willing to make amends to and who you're never going to make amends to, I made the comment to my sponsor that I'm willing to make amends to everybody except for my sister, because I'm currently punishing her for bad behavior, and I don't want to have to do that today. But it's fine, because she's traveling with the carnival, so I won't have any opportunity to see her and have to make amends to her, so we'll just put her on that never list. I won't take editorial freedom and say, well, the next moment she called, but within a relatively short amount of time, like a week or two, I got a call from my mom that said, hey, your sister, who's traveling with the carnival, is in a town real close to where you're working, and she'd really like to see you. That's great. That's awesome. And, of course, immediately called my sponsor and said, what do I do? And he said, well, my suggestion is you go there, and the first thing that you do is you make your amends to her so that you can enjoy the rest of the time that you spend with her. And I thought that was a great idea, so I drove to the town she was at, and, you know, she met me at the gates to the carnival, and, you know, we had some time to talk, and, of course, didn't make the amends then. And then we got on the Ferris wheel, and, of course, she worked there, so we were on that Ferris wheel for, like, an hour, just going in circles, just the two of us in our own cart, and I didn't make the amends then. And, I mean, I was basically there for about 8 hours hanging out, and hadn't had an opportunity yet to say, you know, I was wrong. And as I'm leaving, of course, I'm like, you know, I cannot go home and then call my sponsor tomorrow and say, didn't have a chance. You know, so literally as I was walking out the gate, you know, I turned to her and said, you know, look, I've been wrong, and I was wrong. And the manner in which I've treated you was unacceptable. Is there anything I can do to make that up to you? And we were able to, you know, I was fairly new, and she said, no, it's good. And I'm like, no, you have to give me a reason now. I've been thinking about this amends for months, and you have 3 seconds to give me a real answer. She didn't. You know, but our relationship changed at that point, which was really kind of cool. It's since gone full circle. She's made some choices in her life, and it's... it's changed. You know, it hasn't been rainbows and butterflies since then with my sister. She has some issues that she's working through, and sometimes I'm not a part of that relationship anymore through her choice, not mine. I'm no longer punishing her for bad behavior. Today when I call, I ask her how she's doing, and I just listen, and I don't tell her what she needs to be doing differently or how she needs to fix it. In that same time when I was out there being an evangelist for Al-Anon, I was trying to tell my mom what she needed to do and how she needed to be different, and she very clearly pointed out to me that she knew what recovery was, she knew where it was, and if she ever needed it, she would go find it, and would I just shut up? And I did. You know, I made the amends to her. And, you know, in the book, and you know, I looked at the book before I came up here, and I realized that I had enough time that I could just basically read what it says about the 8th and 9th, and that would take up all of my time, but I didn't think that would be very good. You know, I did become amazed before I was halfway through. You know, people asked, you know, what happened and when did it happen, and at some point while I was making those direct amends to people, I became worthy, or a worthwhile human being just because I was. And I did clear away the wreckage of my past wherever possible and whenever possible, you know, unless to do so would injure them or others. And I didn't get to make that call. You know, my sponsor was the one that was able to talk those things out with me and let me know in those situations where now you don't get to go make amends to her over dinner at a nice restaurant. That's not going to be a good plan. So, you know, that's been the thing for me, is having that sponsor in my life. Just recently, my sponsor went through a pretty traumatic year. He lost his mom and his dad in the same year, and I realized I'd been around quite a while, and I had made amends to my dad, and my dad was the man that I hated. At 12, 13, and 14 years old, I plotted his death. I had diagrams. Not of how to kill him, that was the easy part, but how do you get rid of the body without evidence was the tough thing. And this was a man I was make amends to him. When I got into the military, I worked out for years just so I could come home and kill him with my bare hands, because that seemed a little more personal. And, you know, I got to go home, I mean, and it became time. It wasn't, you know, God's will, and I was walking down a street, and he stepped out of a coffee shop, and it was, you know what, it's time for me to make amends to my dad. And I didn't, I was looking here in here for the directions on how to do it, and, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about a lot of different ways and how they explain what they're doing, you know, and it took me a while. I went home to visit, and it took me 3 or 4 days before my dad was sober enough and coherent enough that I felt it was actually going to be an amends to somebody that was conscious enough to hear it. And that's not my judgment. That's just, I mean, my dad drinks and that's all that he does. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't going to fax in my amends to him. I wanted him to at least be aware that I was talking to him. And you know, the fact that it took 3 or 4 days is kind of painful. It's part of my family history. But I was able to say to him, you know, I didn't show you the respect that you deserved. And is there any way that I can make that up to you? And you know, and you know, his response was, I didn't show you the respect that you deserved either. And our relationship changed. It didn't change immediately, and it didn't, you know, he still does what he does. My dad drinks, and that's what he does. Every day. At some point he decided that the world owed him something, and he's been out to get it ever since then. You know, a lot of our conversations end with me just walking out of the room, but I don't tell him off, and I don't tell him I just have to leave the room, because I've been in arguments with my dad before for an hour when I completely agreed with him, and he had decided to argue, and it didn't matter that I was in complete agreement with him. And, you know, but that's been a gift of this program for me, that I'm able to have a relationship with him that I didn't know that I could ever have. And I love my dad. I know today that he did and is doing the best that he can with the tools that he's got. And that's all that I can ask of him. And, you know, I'm forever grateful for that. On that same trip, I was able to make amends to an old classmate that, you know, was something I hadn't thought of in years and years and years. And the cool thing about that kind of amends for me was, you know, she laughed at me when I made the amends. She was like, oh my God, I do remember that. She's like, I didn't even think about it 10 minutes after it happened. But as a result of my humbling myself and going to her, she was able to share with me that after I had left that school, some things had happened in her life and our entire class had shunned her. So my reaching out to her some 15 years later was a big deal in her world. And it ended up having nothing to do with the fact that I tore her sweatpants playing flag football in sixth grade. So God, you know, I got to be the messenger of, you know, she had no right to be shunned by anybody. And that was awesome. I also got to make amends to my little brother on that trip. You know, my little brother is, he's a cool guy. He's an awesome dad. And I was able to just say to him, you know, because, you know, you don't talk about emotions. You don't talk about anything with my little brother because he's macho. He's the guy. And, you know, but I was able to sit down with him and say, you know, are we good? Is there anything that, you know, are we good? Because I don't want there to be anything between us other than, you know, that we're brothers. And, you know, today we have a relationship where he's able to look at me and say, no, we're good. I didn't come here for that stuff. I didn't. I came in here to get my girlfriend's mom sober. You know, things were going pretty good for me when I came in the doors. It was months after I'd been here where I realized I was sitting up in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking about how she'd screwed up her life, where I realized I had an issue. You know, I suffer from the family disease of alcoholism, and I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, I can't drink it and not feel the effects either. You know, I can't have power over other things. Today I'm powerless. I'm going through some stuff in my life that's not fun stuff. You know, today, happy, joyous, and free for me, you know, I'm not skipping down the sidewalk singing a jolly tune. I'm going through some stuff that's not fun stuff, some clinical stuff, clinical depression, chronic fatigue. I've got some foreclosure going on. I got some bankruptcy going on. And, the difference for me today is I'm okay. As a result of those things happening, I'm not a failure and I'm not a worthless human being. I just got some crap going on that sucks. And I came through the doors with a pretty girlfriend and a good job and a brand new motorcycle and a brand new car, and I was miserable. You know, and today I got the exact opposite going on and I'm still okay. I didn't even know that was possible to be okay with all of this stuff. I had a Tuesday happen about a month and a half ago that there was enough bad stuff happened that day that it would constitute most people's bad year. You know, and I put a call into my sponsor, and had to wait until the next day until I got to talk to my sponsor. And I couldn't have done that without the tools of this program and being in these rooms for as long as I have. I'm forever grateful for that. It's just been an incredible journey, and it's not all, rainbows and butterflies. Sometimes it's life. As a result of this program, I got to, I got a job not too long ago, and I was kind of, I wanted more responsibility, so my boss gave me the problem child in the company. He was a Mexican gangster. I mean, that's what he was. He didn't talk to me, he didn't look at me for about the first, I don't know, a couple days we worked together. It took me about 6 weeks before I actually got him to crack a smile. And I mean, that's what he was. He has an AK-47 at home, he wore a bandana at work. I'm a hillbilly from northern Minnesota. And it took me about 6 weeks to get him to crack a smile. We worked together for about 8, 9 months, 10 months, and I got fired from that job ultimately because, I had a driver's license and a green card, and I expected my boss to treat me like an employee, not a slave, and he didn't appreciate that, so I had to go. And that Mexican gangster that I started working with that didn't smile and didn't talk to me and nobody wanted to work with because he was angry and he was mean, he called me about 4 months ago now. And I'm just like, hey, how's it going? And he's like, it's so bad, so bad. And I'm like, you know, what's going on? And his 12-year-old son had been diagnosed with cancer. And the doctors had just told him that he wasn't going to make it. And they gave him 3 to 5 days. Before I got here, I wasn't the guy that he would have called. I was the guy he would have hated because I was a control freak and I was a jerk all of the time because you weren't doing it the way I thought you should be doing it. And Alan gave me the gift that I got to be there for him. And I didn't know what to say and I didn't know what to do, but I knew that when he called and gave me that information that I needed to go. And I was able to say, wow, that sucks. Where are you? You know, and he said, we're at Children's, and if you could find some time to come down, I'd appreciate it. And I was like, I'm on my way. I'll be right there. And, you know, I can't ever give that back. I can't ever give that back to anybody. That's the gifts that I get from coming through the doors of being able to be there for somebody else and be of maximum use to God and my fellows. And today, you know, I don't go to meetings for the newcomer. I go to meetings so that I can have this life, so that I can not live and feel like I used to live and feel. You know, and if something I'm doing or saying helps somebody else, great. But I'm still here as a recovered member. I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Absolutely. But I got to keep doing this deal or I go to an unhappy, dark place and I don't want to go back there. It sucked. And this is a much better place. It's been an awesome conference. The honesty from this podium is always, always incredible and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Jeremy B. from Primary Purpose Group in Costa Mesa, California. Thank you.
I'm Jeremy. I'm an alcoholic.
Jeremy.
And, you know, it's an honor to be here at this conference. And I've been coming the last 3 years, kind of a strange series of coincidences, as many things in sobriety are, of how I got here. You know, a phone call from a friend in New York told me a name, a speaker tape. The guy on the speaker tape, you know, Mark, you know, had a huge influence on this. And then that year, I had gotten my girlfriend pregnant, and the baby was due at the time, at the week of my normal annual men's retreat. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I should go and check out this retreat out in Colorado. Got a couple of guys together. We came out, and it was just kind of a, you know, it renewed my curiosity, my interest, my excitement, you know, for Alcoholics Anonymous. At the time, I my sobriety date's July 24th, 2002. So it's usually around the week of this conference is I'm taking that next year, you know, and so I'll be coming up on 11 years this year. I found out about that around seven, eight years. And, you know, it's just been remarkable, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I, you know, did I do everything perfect from the time I came in? No, you hear, you know, Primary Purpose Group, think, oh, this guy's going to be a big book thumper. And I just love those people because I love the enthusiasm. I love the truth about it. And I've seen what it's done in my community. I was one of the co-founding members of one of their book study format meetings in my community, and it's had a ripple effect there. And our meeting is about 120 people. Average age is probably about 22, you know, and so a lot of, you know, we got guys, pick them off one at a time. They join the group. You know, our core group is getting bigger and bigger. They're staying sober. They're taking chips. Their lives are being recreated. You know, they've got power back in their life, and it's just an amazing thing to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous in that level, you know, and partially due to this conference and this fellowship in particular. So getting home from this conference last year, you know, I celebrated 10 years of sobriety, you know, and I got home to a note on my kitchen counter that I had that the girlfriend had become a fiance, and then I had a 10-month-old daughter. And I got home to a note on the counter saying I needed to find a new place to live, you know, in a house that I paid all the bills. And, you know, and basically, you know, I said, how could God do this to me? someone explained, hey, this is not a failure of God. This is a failure of you to live a life based on self-will. This is a failure of Jeremy running the show. And it was very clear to me and evident. And speaking about 8 and 9, you know, a lot of times the 8 step, it's like we make the list. We make the list. You know, there's a couple sentences about it. And it says we make a list and then we prepare to, take care of this wreckage, which is accumulated out of not from our drinking, but it says from efforts to live a life based on self and run this, I was like, geez, So I'm going to actually quote something out of the 12 and 12, which, says step 8 and 9, we're concerned with personal relations. First, we take a look backward and try to discover where we've been at fault. Next, we make the vigorous attempt to repair the damage we've done. And this was a part I'd always missed out on. And third, having thus cleared away the debris of the past, we considered how, with our newfound knowledge of ourselves, we may develop the best possible relations with every human being we know. I thought, man. And I said, okay, with this girl, yeah, I've done a lot of damage. She's obviously on the list. A sponsor kind of pointed this. We went through it out of this 12 and 12 and pointed this out to me. And I thought, I know what my amends list is. It's here. It's these 15 names. And he's been watching me around the rooms of AA, for the last year. And he said, well, what about that time that this guy came up and talked to you and you kind of dusted him, like maybe you were better than him, or, you got more time, or you think you know more. And I said, And that list from 15 people went to about, 60, 70, 80 people. And what it was is I had to look at how I interacted with people, how I treated people. Because failures on that big level with that relationship, is very obvious. But what about how I treat the guy at the coffee place, how I treat the guy at the car wash, how I treat the convenience store, how I treat people in my home group that are doing the best that they can. They're doing the best that they can with what they know. How do I look down on them? Look down my nose on some spiritual hilltop and look at these people, or do I have love, tolerance, kindness? Help show that. Am I worried about this in every relation with every human being? And so that 8 step, where that list is, it's really become like, instead of a list, it's like a tool that I can. I'm willing to make amends to these people. I go over to my sponsor. Not all of them do I owe an amends to, but it's like I can look at this relationship. Look how I affected, how I affected this person, how I harmed this person. What was my interaction here? And hopefully, I've got 11 years of sobriety, almost 11 years of sobriety, and I mean, I'm really deficient in the area of relations, even here amongst you all. And so, and then the last paragraph of that. We should avoid extreme judgments, both of ourselves and of others involved. We must not exaggerate our own defects or theirs. A quiet, objective view will be our steadfast aim. Whenever our pencil falters, we can fortify and cheer ourselves by remembering what AA experience in this step has meant to others. It is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. So all of a sudden, that 8 step, that stupid list, has become this catapult, this trampoline, this springboard that if I can effectively use that, it could really start to end the isolation between you all, me, God. It's just, I'm a seeker. And that's another way I think I can get a little bit more relief and a little bit more power and become a little more useful, to those around me. And, and as far as the 9th step, as far as the 9th step go, I could sit up here and tell you 9 step stories for 2 hours, and make people. I don't cry that much. I feel like I don't fit in because I don't cry that much, but I could probably get some tears, maybe make some other people cry, and tell you these stories, and it's weird because in the last 3 speaking things I've done, I had this thing with this lawnmower that I sabotaged on community service at this airport when I was 16 that the guy on the speaker tape talked about becoming consciously aware. I forgot that in my initial list, but this was 16 years later. I'm contacting this airport like, hey, I need to make this right. I broke your lawnmower. No one would call me back. They probably thought I was crazy. Well, the day of, I got these emails, God bless you. Come visit us, all this stuff. And then I was speaking somewhere that night. the last time I had this girl who I destroyed her life, and I hadn't seen her in 3 years, and I was with my daughter, and I was riding with a friend to go buy some jeans at some fancy store, which I would never go to, and she worked there. You know, I didn't know how to, and I got her number, and I, you know, now I got a forum that I can make amends, and I did that, and I was speaking that night. Today, I'm in between the potluck and this. I'm laying in my room, and I get a call from a sponsee, and I just want a nap. You know, I got my eyeballs feel like they're popping out of my head. My throat's dry. I got a headache. I'm peeing nonstop. I can't, like, this altitude thing. I just want to take a break. This guy's calling me. I don't want to talk to him. I answer the phone. It's a guy I've been sponsoring for the last 4 years. He's got a sponsee that just took a year yesterday. And he's calling me to let me know that he was very excited because from our first meeting, he was concerned about the money that he owed. And he was calling me to let me know, I wrote the final check today, man, and I feel great. You know, and it was like, and now here I am speaking. You know, and so I'm an experienced guy. You know, I love getting an experience in AA. I want to be able to come here and twist around the words, explain things more eloquently, sound better, smarter, more advanced, a better student. It's not me. I bump my head against the wall. I go the other direction. I bump my head. I'm a seeker. I'm curious. I just, that's how I work in AA, you know. And another quick amends story, you know, and this is current stuff. This is current stuff. And 2 weeks ago, prior to June 10th, June 9th, I called my buddy Charlie in Texas. I'm telling him, hey, you know, 7 years of sobriety, I got a phone call on a Sunday night. Hey, your dad was just killed in a car accident. I hadn't had a chance to make amends to my father. Okay, now this is almost 4 years later. You know, and I just had a chance to do it 2 weeks ago, but wrote a letter. You know, I went through the garage. I dug out his ashes out of the Ziploc bag in some box I stored somewhere. And I called Charlie. I said, hey, Charlie, you know, I'm going to climb this mountain. I put my lottery thing in February. My date they gave me was June 10th. I'm going to take the ashes. I'm going to take this letter that I wrote to this man that can't be seen. I'm going to make my amends to my dad on top of this mountain. It's a Mount Whitney, you know, tallest mountain in America. It's symbolic, whatever, more spiritual. It's the tallest one, you know. And so I'm going up there. It's 100 degrees in altitude, zero elevation. Start going up. So I'm going to pack light because I want to move fast. So I leave my gloves behind. You know, I leave my gloves behind. Well, actually, Charlie said, why June 10th? I said, that's the day I was awarded through this lottery system of thousands of people. He goes, did you have any idea that was a birthday? You know, that's Dr. Bob's sobriety day, birthday to AA. I thought, fuck, like a little God shot there, you know, great. So I left my gloves, right? It's hot. I don't need gloves. It's 100 degrees. I leave my gloves, and we're going up. All of a sudden, it starts snowing, you know? And it's the winds are 40 miles an hour. Yeah, everyone knows, 14,000 feet, the elevation, you know, the weather can change. And, my friend that was with me, he had two gloves, and he only had one walking stick. So he said, hey, I'll give you my one glove, and I'll put my hand in my pocket, and I'll use my walking stick. I said, man, well, great, you know, that's great. And then at least I have one glove, and we can just keep switching hands, and we'll be all good. Not more than like 2 minutes down that path, there was a glove laying in the path, and it was the opposite hand. It was the hand I needed. And I thought, you know, here I am coming here to make these amends to my father. My father was a mountain man. He was a sailor. He was climbed mountains. He raced across oceans. He did all this stuff. And here I am doing this amends. I'm doing the best I can in AA to take the action, to get that contact, you know. And then there was this glove, you know. And I just said, I knew it. I said, that's my dad. You know, he put the glove there, whatever. But I just knew it, you know. And I went to the top and I threw the ashes and everyone's looking at me. There's a couple of guys up there. But I did it, you know. I'm doing the work. I'm getting the results, you know. And I loved what the speaker had said last night, without help, because I love that. Without help, I gotta have help. I gotta be transparent with a group of men, you know, with my little home groups there. I gotta be accountable. I gotta know what's going on, you know. And for the first time, I'm not that guy on page 73 that leads a double life, you know, that I'm presenting a stage character at the podium in my home group. I talk smack. I'm not that guy. I'm praying. I'm meditating every morning. I'm making amends. I have guys in the steps. I have, you know, I'm doing AA, and it feels great. My tension, my anxiety, my stress, my stuff is going down. you know, and I feel like I'm alive, I'm living, I'm happy, I'm joyous, I'm free, you know, and I'm so excited for my life today, for Alcoholics Anonymous, for those people around me, the relationships. I'm probably screw a few more up, but, you know, I'm figuring it out, I'm working on it. But it's and it's such an honor and a pleasure, and you know, to be asked to come up here and to maybe, you know, break down the barriers between you all. You know, I'm just it's just amazing. So thank you.
Thank you. Derek M. from Denver, Thursday night, Denver, Colorado.
My name is Derek Mountain. I'm an alcoholic. I've been a sober and active member of Alcoholics Anonymous since September 29th of 01. And my home group is the Denver Thursday Night Group. And you guys look beautiful from up here. I'm glad to be here. It just occurred to me that it was 9 years ago on this panel that my, what is now my wife, spoke and started this train of discovering that she was the woman I was meant to spend the rest of my life with, and I love you guys. I thank the committee for everything that you've done, and all the panelists that have spoken and will yet speak, and the speakers that have spoken and will yet speak, and this has been a fantastic weekend so far. So it's only through sponsorship and in looking in hindsight that I've been able to piece together the pieces of my life before alcohol, during alcohol, and since alcohol. And it's through that sponsorship out of the Big Book that I've discovered that I'm a spiritual thief. And that I've been looking for power in any number of things for as long as I can remember. And when I was young, that was in books. I loved to read. I loved to escape. I loved to imagine that I was in some other place and time, because the place and time that I was in right here, right now, was horrible. And it was all in my head. On the outside, everything looked, for the most part, okay. I mean, there was alcoholism. I was raised by a single mother, but there was love. There was clean clothes. There was food. But in my mind, I was separate from, and I was less than, and I just didn't simply add up. So I escaped in books. And as I grew older, I discovered that I could escape much faster, much easier into a bottom of a bottle of Jack Daniels. And that took me to a deep, dark place in which I was ripe for a spiritual awakening. My spirit was ready to be awakened. I was willing to go anywhere and do anything to not be the person that I had become. And I started to grasp onto this belief very early on that God is deep down within every man, woman, and child. And I've been looking out here. I've been looking everywhere but within me and within you. And if lack of power is my dilemma, and if power resides within me and power resides within you, then why not do a fourth step? Why not start to look at how it is that my resentments and my fears and my sexual conduct manifest themselves in my life and in my relationships with you and cut me off from you? And I start to recognize that every time I harmed you, whoever you happen to be, that I was cutting myself off from that power just a little bit more. And I carried this shame and this guilt and this remorse for many, many years. And I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of mornings I woke up with this foggy or clear recollection of what I had done the night before, and felt this shame and this guilt and this remorse, and approached the person with an apology so that they would let me off the hook, so that they would not think less of me. But none of that made me feel any better. None of that made them really feel any better. And especially towards the end of my drinking, they would say, "Yeah, yeah. You know what, why don't you just go on over there? I've heard it enough." But I go through this inventory and I sit down and I fifth step in and I start to get clearer and clearer on the harm that I've caused. And I know that the eighth step is coming, and I've done my sixth step and my seventh step, and I pretty much have a list for my amends in my eighth step. But there are people that were on my first eighth step, especially my first eighth step, that I had no resentment against, that I needed to add to that list, that I was very clear I had harmed. Okay, and got to do a little bit extra digging to get clearer on the harm with my sponsors so that I would not approach them and cause more harm in the amends. And there was for sure some trepidation in approaching these people But I thought I was very excited, and I was. I think I was at the beginning, to do at least those three or four that were just weighing on me the heaviest. And I sat down with my sponsor, and we went over the harm, and I said, you know, I went over exactly what I was going to say so that I would not bring their faults into the picture. And I went out, and I made them, and I felt better. And I rested on my laurels. Because this is what I do. I'm a good friend used to say I'm a good starter and a bad finisher, right? I can do the sprint really well, but I'm not in for the long haul. So I made these three or four. I felt great, and then I went about my business. And I was sitting down with my sponsor one night, and he says, "How are your men's going?" And I said, "They're okay." And he said, "How are your financial amends going?" And I owed a lot of money. And I said, "Well, I'm willing, but I've got such and such bills and XYZ is going on." And he just smiled and said, "Why don't you go pray about it?" And so I did. I went up to my apartment, and it was like the size of this stage. And I earnestly prayed about it. And I had before this had little burning blades of grass that were showing up in my life, in which I could recognize the power of God showing up in my life, mostly through you. But I went up and I earnestly prayed if there was any way that God saw fit that I could start freeing up some money, if it was $5 at a time or $20 at a time, to start making these reparations, to start giving them back their money. It was not my money in the first place. And a couple of days later, I got a letter back from the city and county of Denver clerk's office. I showed up here with two felony convictions, and I had two felony cases that I was paying reparations on per the judge's orders, but I was doing like $20 a month on one and $20 a month on the other, and I'd gotten this letter, and it said, it was a receipt really is what it was, and it said at the bottom, balance owed zero. Now, I've prayed on Tuesday, if you see fit, to show me the way to make these amends, and on Thursday, I get this receipt back from the city and county of Denver, and I called up the clerk's office thinking there's been a mistake. I do not immediately think God has answered my prayer. I think there's been a mistake. So I call and I talk to the clerk, and she says, "Well, you're not going to believe this, but the judge, the very judge who had locked me up many, many times, has waived my fees and fines because he's seen the progress that I've made in Alcoholics Anonymous, in society, in reaching out to the Denver Drug Court. And by now I'm ecstatic." And I said, "Can you please do me a favor while you're in the system, look at this other case and tell me what my exact to the penny balance is so that I can make a conscious effort to really pay this down?" And she said, "Well, you're not going to believe this, but you owe zero on this case as well." And I knew right then and there that this attitude that I had approached God in my third step, that "God, please take away these difficulties so that I may bear witness," was starting to happen. These fines were not waived so that I could buy a car and take newcomers to meetings. They were not waived so that I could, brag about, "Look what happened to me." They were waived so that I could bear witness to the power that exists in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the 12 steps, in the big book, in God. And I went out and I talked about this, and I made a couple of more amends, and I rested on my laurels. And I was up here, maybe it was 04, and the Sunday morning speaker posed a question to the audience that felt like it was directed exactly at me and said, "Are you sitting here in this room right here, right now, claiming to have had a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps or as the result of 9.5 steps? Have you made all of your amends that you are consciously aware of?" And I shrunk into my seat just a little bit more. Because I hadn't. I had been resting on my laurels. And I, after the conference, examined that initial list and looked at how many more do I have and made a conscious effort to make the rest of those amends by the next Fellowship of the Spirit. A lot of those had to do with money. A lot of those had to do with potential jail time. But I was in a position where I was single and I could do that. And I went out and I made these reparations. And of that initial list, there are three people that I have not yet made amends to because I don't know what their name is. When you're dealing in the environment that I was dealing with, people don't always freely share their full name. So I can't look for Spanky on Google or Facebook. Like, I don't know what his name is. If I run into him at the store, I'm willing to make that right. But In our big book, it says, yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. So my father was on that first list. And I made several attempts to make an arrangement to sit down and make amends with him. And this is a man who suffered greatly from the disease of alcoholism. And he continued to blow me off. He would say he was unavailable. He would make an arrangement to meet and not show up. Whatever. And I eventually just threw my hands up and said, when it's supposed to happen, it will happen. And he and I happened to be having dinner one time. And I went deep with inside and said, is now the time? And it felt like it was. And I just made the amends right then and there. And it was very freeing. And he wound up admitting some of his wrongs to me in the process. And I felt good about it. And a couple of years later, my brother got sober. And he made amends to my dad. And my dad said, well, that's all fine and well. But when's your brother going to make his amends? He's been sober a lot longer than you. And I realized he was in a blackout when I made the amends. So I called my sponsor and I said, what do I do? And he said, well, do you feel free? I mean, you did it. And I said, yeah. And he said, then what's the issue? I want him to know. Well, he may never know. He's in a blackout nearly every day. He may never know. So just pray about it. And if something more is supposed to happen, then something more will happen. And about 5.5 years ago, I got a call that he was in the hospital dying of alcoholism. And it did not occur to me to not go. It did not occur to me to bring up all of those things, because he was sitting still in a bed, all of those things that he had not shown up for or not done or had done. It just occurred to me to show up and be there and be a son regardless, to not bring up his glaring defects. And I had opportunity for those last 6 weeks of his life to just sit and be with him, to ask the nurse to leave the room and allow me to feed him, rather than her sit there and feed him while I watched. To offer assistance in rolling him over to change his diaper. And to bring him meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit there and just tell them that he is loved, knowing that he is going to leave this planet in a very short time, probably feeling unloved. And in his passing, I felt that there was nothing left undone and nothing left unsaid. That the amends had come full circle. And this is what is available to us. But my struggle is in my day-to-day life. It's still within my family. My mother told me in my amends that all she ever wanted was to see me happy. Now, I'd spent the last 6 months of my drinking homeless, and she didn't know if I was dead or alive from one day to the next. And when I got arrested on that last case, she was thanking God because she knew that I was alive and I was safe and I was in a jail cell. And she says, all I want to do is see you safe and happy. And I did that for a number of years. But she has some bipolar going on. And so when she started getting manic, I started withdrawing. And I started not showing up in her life and showing her that I was happy. She would come over to see the girls, and I would go find something to do. I'm not doing this consciously. This is all in hindsight that I realize that this is what I'm doing. So I had opportunity to sit down with her yet again. And I talked to her a little bit about my concerns about her emotional and her mental well-being, in which she didn't realize she was being this way, and she went and sought outside help. And that was prudent. As her son, I was concerned. What was not prudent was that I was shutting her out of my life. I was no longer sharing with her the joy that I was experiencing in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my work life, in my family life. I was just there, and that was it. At my home is probably the hardest place. I can look good. Nicole set the stage for me. Okay, I can look good and I can sound good for 2 or 3 hours a day in a meeting with a sponsee and whatever in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how to look good. I know how to sound good. But what do I look like behind closed doors? What do I look like at work? I'm a manager. I have 14 direct reports that come to me. What do I look like? Do I wave my finger at them and tell them, you're going to do it because I'm the boss and because I said so? Or do I show up with an attitude that I'm here to serve this team, that I'm merely here to steer the boat and tweak things a little bit so that they can be the most efficient team that they can be? And I do both. But I have opportunity to show up and tell them, you know what, and I do this mostly in a 10th step, but sometimes in a 9th step, I will come to them and say, you know what, the way that I talked to you was wrong. I feel that I caused harm, and there's no reason that you should have felt the way that you had felt. The real truth is that I'm afraid about my position, and I'm afraid that if things don't look good out here, I don't look good. That's foreign to a lot of individuals. But to my team, that's not so foreign. More and more they're getting used to, oh, here comes Derek again. He's not going to say he's sorry. He's going to say he's wrong. But in my home life, that's the hardest part. And that's where I have to continue to 10th step with you, with my sponsor, continue to inventory and continue to show up and not get so caught up in how I look or being the financial provider or whatever it is that I can get wrapped up in, because I can seek power to this day in any number of things. But when my wife says, how are you feeling? And the best I can come up with is, I'm tired and hungry and my back hurts. That's not what she's looking for. She's looking for, how am I feeling? What are my fears? What are my resentments? What is going on within me? And that's not what I want to tell you. That's not what I want to tell her. Because my head tells me, if I tell you that, then you will know that I'm real. Then you will know that I'm genuine. Then you will know that I'm sick. And that's where I find the most relief. That's when I feel closest to you, is when I'm telling you the truth and you're telling me the truth. And yet my head will tell me the opposite. So with that, I'm going to sit down and listen to Gary, and I love you all. Thanks.
Thank you. Gary B., The Digs, Indianapolis, Indiana.
Man, Derek, that's good stuff.
Thank you, all of you.
Gary, I'm an alcoholic. Gary. I died age December 3rd, 1964, which means I'm sober longer than many of you are old, and I just like to bring that up first. I have the good fortune of being one of the members of the group of men who went through the book as a group in Denver, because we got the idea from some men in a group in Winnipeg, Canada. And one of us was more attuned than the rest of us of what we might do with that. And so we went through the book and the steps with the best of what we had. And each of us kind of went out on our own. I, shortly after that, ended up effectively running away and moving to Indianapolis, Indiana. I shouldn't really phrase it that way, because it wasn't done without prayer and thought and discussion with my wife, Julie, and that. But you say a prayer, and the next day you get a phone call from a guy in Nashville, Tennessee, saying, I'd sure like you to come out here and go to work for me in the Midwest. And I'm thinking about that. I went to the Denver Young People's meeting a few nights later, and I said, could that have been an answer to prayer? And one of the girls in that says, sure beats hell out of a bolt of lightning. And so effectively, to oversimplify things, we packed up and moved out there. And so and that's just an aside that what happened. So most of the things I'm talking about was after we left Denver, and that, and I had kind of lost my way because I was out of the womb, so to speak. I didn't have the daily regular contact that Don and I and Bob and a bunch of us had, and that sort of thing. And I don't know that I would have used them as well as I could have had I been in Denver, because I got away from that and things changed. And my behavior fell back sober to a point that I have friends now who know me since I went and took some fifth steps with them about that time that can't believe I stayed sober. And if you look back on that, it's hard to believe that I stayed sober. So anyway, I think I'll share with you what happened after that and with that amends trip, largely because it was a much better job of it, frankly, than what I did. The first time was, at best, was half-assed, and that's the best I can say about it. But I found myself in serious trouble emotionally and financially and any other way you want to look at it. My conduct had been bad in all areas of my life. And the day came when I called a guy called Paul M. He lived in Chicago. And I had met him years ago here in Denver and that. And I knew him as a step Nazi, and I knew that's what I had to get back to somehow. And there wasn't anybody in Indianapolis that I found that had any experience with the book and the steps. And I felt as bad as I was, I knew more about AA than they did. But they weren't screwing up like I was. But I called him one day, and I said, is there any possibility that a man with 23 years of sobriety, a grandfather, and all this going on in his life could be going through male menopause? And Paul said, well, maybe. But I think if you review your first three steps as hard as you can, write another inventory, and come up and take some fifth steps, we can put you and make, go ahead and make some amends. Your life will change, and I'll do that. And I know what I said to him is, I'll do anything you say. And I think I meant it more than when I first had been through the steps and had my first idea that I was really a real alcoholic, and that I really was helpless and I couldn't manage my life. I'm sure that was my case. So anyway, I did. I wrote an inventory, and I had written any number of attempts at inventories, and this one, I wrote an entirely new resentment list. These were not old ones that had reappeared. Not that that doesn't happen on occasion, but not this time. This was all current stuff. What you think about it really ought to scare you a little bit anyhow, because that means we're able, or at least I'm able, to cause as much or more harm stone sober as I ever did in my drinking and my early sobriety. And I did the fear list, and that was like a lot of the same old stuff and a lot of the current stuff in that. But in my conduct inventory, I went back as far as I could, and I remembered everybody I could possibly remember. And I took them through the 9 questions, each one of them, and wrote that. And I called Paul, and I told him that I was finished. And he told me to be at a motel in, out in LaGrange, Illinois, on the west side of Chicago, and to be there by, I don't know what it was, 6-7 o'clock on a Friday night. And I found the motel, and I ran across, got my room, went across the street, got a cup of gas station coffee, and brought it back. And there was a knock on my door, and the guy said he was Dennis O'Brien. He was 29 years sober. He was there to swap fifth steps with me. And so I took a fifth step with him and 8 other guys over the weekend. And at the end of the weekend, Paul said, come meet us at this pancake house that for what it's worth, I've had lots of breakfast there since then. But and meet us there, and we went there. And there were 3 or 4 of the guys that had taken the fifth steps with there. And they suggested that I take my pad and pencil out, and they would help me with my amends list. And they really had good memories. So I did. We took the last time. And we went through that. And Paul asked the question, how about those people that you owe amends to that are not on your resentment list? He made it really clear. And that literally made up probably half my amends list at that point in time. Over the years, Julie and I had accumulated a great deal of debt, borrowing from parents, from AA members, from Dial Finance and all that, and signing the legal work to make sure you pay it back. And apparently I had no intentions of paying any attention to the legal work with that. And so they all ended up on that. And the guys were there. Some of them, like I say, Paul at that point in time must have had about crowding 40 years of sobriety, but the other guys were 29 years. And I'm taking fifth steps with guys with 2 or 3 years. They're pulling rank on me, and that was my job with 23 years, you know. And so they couldn't believe I had stayed sober through that. They said, how in the hell did you do that? What happened? And there must be a God, because I don't have any other answer for that. That's the only thing it could be. And just an aside now, I've been around a long, long time. I've met people all over the country and the world and that sort of thing. And I got to tell you, most of those that have had significant sobriety, whatever significant is, I don't want to put a year on it because there's some really significant sobriety out there. We've heard them up here today with less than 4 or 5 years. But those that seem to go back out and drink do so with unfinished amends. I just want to throw that out. The people that didn't show up for this one, I relate to, because I guarantee you, I was not showing up at 8th and 9th Steps workshops anywhere I was until after I got caught up in this. So if you're looking for somebody to pray for, why don't you throw them on your list? So I went back with my instructors to start. We got to find a way to start doing that. And I sat down and I showed the list to Julie. And she had been with me with many of those trips to parents and people to borrow money from and that. And she felt that these things were as much her amends as mine. And so she agreed to what it was going to take to do that. So that was on a Tuesday night. We decided we would start with her parents. And so I called and her dad answered the phone. And the financial amends weren't handled by him. They were handled by Julie's mom. But I owed him amends. And I did the best I could do on the phone with him that now. Then was I thanked him for the kindness he'd shown me all the years of my misbehavior, even drunk and sober. And I knew that I had worried him sick about the way I had treated Julie and our children, his grandchildren. Because he loved them probably more than I did. I mean, he really did. And then I made a mistake. And I told him that I was there because I had to do some things to show that I could put some character in my life. And I made a mistake and I told him that I loved him. And he said, "Aw, shit." And he gave the phone to Grandma. And so I went through the same routine with her. And I got down to that. I did not tell her I loved her because I knew she'd hang up. And I said, "Have you any idea how much money you've given us over the years?" And she said, "Right down to the last penny." So we made arrangements to start paying that back. Another person I had to call was an AA member in Minnesota who... we had become speakers, friends at a young people's conference. That was before they called it YPA or IKIPA or PUKIPA or whatever it is. And you got to understand, I got a little attitude about that because the Denver Young People's Group was an AA group. It wasn't a movement. And I'm sorry, we're really not seeing that one hand. But then on the other hand, they seem to be helping a lot of kids, don't they? It's working well, so maybe I ought to shape up. Years before that, my friend Bob from Minnesota had called me because we had made friends at this conference down in Houston. And he said, "I'm on my way to talk at a how much time do I have?
15.
Okay. He just stopped by to see us. We've become good friends. And again, you got to flash back here a little bit because when I met him at the airport, when he stopped by to see us, he said, "You look like hell. What's going on?" And I hadn't told him about the financial position I put ourselves in. And I said, "I'm worried sick." I said, "They're going to foreclose on our home tomorrow morning. And Julie doesn't know that. And I'm afraid it'll kill her." And I got relief from that. And I really did. So we're driving past downtown on the way out to where we live. And Bob said, "Where's your bank? Or where's the bank?" And I said, "What bank?" He says, "The one that has a note on your house." And he said, I said, "Well, just right downtown." And so he says, let's go talk to them, see what we can get them to do. And I said, "Bob, they really don't want any more talk. They're damn tired of talk." And so we went down there. He walked in. We sit down. There's a very angry banker there. And Bob's up by the desk. I'm back trying to get in the corner. And this guy came out with a stack of papers. And Bob says, "What's it going to take to get Gary caught up on his mortgage?" Guy looked and gave him a number, and Bob reached in his pocket and pulled out a roll of checks, traveler's checks and cash, and covered a big nut we had there, right then and there. And I watched him do it. We were caught up at that minute. Walked out the door, and I'm stunned. I can't tell you how stunned I was. And I said, "I got to pay that back." And he said, "It's your problem." I had no clue how right he was. So at any rate, let's pass on. There was a couple other instances there. We fought paying it back for quite a while, and we weren't making that headway because, you know, I couldn't cover everything with one paycheck. He went down and he spent all the money he had, saved gas and grocery money, and went to the next payday, and we'd do that. Julie and I talked about it one day, and she said, "Maybe we could sell a house, cash in your retirement, and pay off all the bills and kind of get things going on, make all those amends that way." I thought she was crazy, but we did that. And with some coaching from my sponsor, he didn't think that was my idea to do that. And when I told him it wasn't, he said he thought so. He thought it was Julie's. So. We did that. We did that. It took a few months to sell the house. I called around and I got all those bills, amends I'd started to make over the years and all that. And I got the number and we set the check. And we moved into a mobile home in the north end of town. But we were free. And it really was. And that place was free. And I haven't dodged anything like that. Oddly enough, we haven't been in serious financial trouble since then. It's not that we've made a hell of a lot of money or done all that. Then a few years ago, Julie says, "You know, you're going to die before I do. Maybe I ought to learn how to handle a checkbook." Well, clearly she could do a better job than I did. And so she took over, I don't know what it was, 2, 3, 4 years ago. And it's great because we always got money. That wasn't the case when I did it. I don't understand it. I really do understand it. And I have no interest at all in changing it. I think I would say that anymore, I feel derelict if I let a sponsee get away and not keep my foot in him about getting through the steps. And anymore, I don't get many new guys. I find myself getting what Paul was getting with all his sobriety. He died with 62 years sober and that, but from the time he was 35 or so, because there weren't many 35 years old at that time, he was one of the few. He was getting the old timers like me with 20, 23 years who were showing up with the jam on their face and their fannies hanging out because they'd been behaving badly sober and doing those things. Well, guess who I'm getting now? And we're a problem, thank you. We're a problem because we already know it all. And so I get to work with that, and it's helpful to me, and every once in a while I get to help some of them. But thank you very much.
Thank you to all the panelists. We'll now open the mic for sharing on step 8 and 9. Thank you.
My name's Phyllis, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I heard a lot of good things. Thank you. I've heard a lot of the good things all weekend, and I really appreciate it. I got sober in 1980. I was pretty young. And so my first 10th step was really pretty easy. It was mom, dad, and brother. My mom just wanted me to call her and talk to her. And I did that every Monday until she died when I had 11 years of sobriety. And I'm ever grateful to the program for allowing me to have that 11 years with my mom. My brother, or my dad, he just wanted me to get my GED. And I did. And I passed in the top 10% of the whole United States without even studying for it. You know, we're just such smart assholes, you know. Or excuse my language. And my brother, I gave him his first joint, my baby brother. And I made my amends to him. And he was like, oh no, you just love me. And I said, yeah, I love you, but it still isn't right and I need to do something. What can I do? And he said, nothing. He said, you know, I've always loved having the coolest sister. You know, everybody said, you know, everybody knew my brother by Phyllis's. That's Phyllis's brother. You know, I talked for my brother. He was born with a hearing problem and he said my name was Wallace. And so until he got his hearing corrected, I always spoke with him. And when he did get sober at one point, I had to learn how to quit talking for him. You know, he would walk into the rooms and he would start to say something and I knew what he had to say. And I told everybody what he had to say. So that was some work I had to do. And he went back out when he had 4 years of sobriety before my mother passed away. And I find it really interesting this weekend. The man that spoke last night, he had a sister that loved him and he was on the streets. And my brother, he follows me around. He's in Albuquerque. And he knows my doors are there. I've had to do a lot of Al-Anon work to understand that my brother doesn't drink because he doesn't love me. He drinks because he's an alcoholic, you know. And he doesn't drink because I gave him his first joint. And I made my amends to him. And he knows where I am. And when he had a year of sobriety, when he went into treatment program, the people from his work gave him a card that had footprints in the sand on it. And he had never heard that poem before. And so when he got a year of sobriety, I did a counted cross stitch on footprints in the sand for him and presented it to him, got it framed. And he had it for years. I don't know if he has it anymore or not. He's homeless. And the last time I talked to him was on Mother's Day last year. And so recently I started doing counted cross stitch again. And I picked up footprints in the sand and thought, I'll make it for myself. And, you know, I find it interesting that that's what the young man that had a sister that loved him so much that spoke the last night, that was his point too. So I still pray for Randy. And I know there's miracles in this program. And I'm clear. But I, you know, it would be nice if he could come back in because he does better. He does. When he was in the program, his program was so strong. His only problem was the four step. The four step was really hard for my brother. So anyway, I continue to pray for him. Thank you.
I'm Priscilla from Al-Anon.
Hi,
Priscilla. Hi. I just wanted to share a couple things on my eighth step. When I was doing my eighth step, I had made my list, and I was getting ready to do my amends, and I'm from back east, so all of my amends, or the majority of them, were all from the wreckage I had caused back east. And wouldn't you know, I happened to, a plane ticket fell in my lap that I had to use within a month, and so I just used that, flew back east, and made a lot of my amends. And it was just, so that's one of many, many, many God examples. how I'm given whatever I need, and I just have to take that next right step. Another amend that I had to make was I had stolen a pair of sweatpants in high school, and I needed to give back a pair of sweatpants. And I was talking with my sponsor, and I said, I don't want to give them to Goodwill. I really want to give them to the domestic violence for abused women shelter. And I called them, and I just felt really strong about that. I called them, and they said, normally we don't take donations, but a woman came in just last night that needs a pair of sweatpants. So just one of so many examples there. And having a lot of Al-Anon issues, when looking at my inventory work, I saw that, you know, I had thought that I was such a victim. And I saw that really what it was I didn't speak up at the right times. I wasn't an advocate for myself. I hated myself. And so I put myself in those situations. And I learned that what I need to do is speak. And I loved what one of the speakers shared about. I'll just read it again. It's the beginning of the end of isolation. And for me, I see that I have to do living amends, and I am such an isolator by nature. Oh, I am shaking up here speaking, but my sponsor says, every meeting you go to, get up and share. I don't care if your voice shakes or whatever. And I do. And for me, I have to just have God living and working in and through me 24 hours a day. And that is my way of making living amends. And I didn't realize that, like, a lot of the ways that I act, like I'll be hunched in, or I'll arrive late to a meeting so that to tick people. Well, I didn't realize this, but you know, that kind of was a great way of ticking people off. And you know, all these other things that I was doing unconsciously. I try to the best of my ability, and I fail a lot, but I try to just, with every step, okay, God, what's my next right move? And I know that a lot of it for me is getting out of the house and not isolating and getting up and speaking. Thank you.
My name's Jill. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. A friend asked me to share this with you. When I was 5 years old, my parents got divorced. And my mom took me to court with her that day, but I wasn't in the courtroom. And when it was all over, my dad came out and said, you know, I'm going to be leaving for a while. And he walked away. And I was whisked off into these judges' chambers, and I was adopted by the guy my mom was marrying, and I lived with him and my mom until, you know, it was time to go away to school, and he wasn't a very nice guy. Anyway, I had a big hole. I wanted a dad all my life. And so I saw my real dad a couple of times when I was living in Washington, D.C. before I got sober. And he wasn't really, I didn't think, like, you know, an okay person. I had judgment. So about 4 years ago, I was going through the steps, and he was on my resentment list. And when I came around to do my eighth and ninth step, you know, I said, you know, he left. He left. And my sponsor said, well, did you know where he was? And I said, yes. And she said, well, don't you think you need to make amends for shutting him out of your life all these years? And I know amends means change. And I was scared because I didn't know if I was ready to, like, be his daughter. I was 55. So I called him up when the time came. And it took me a couple weeks to find him because he was visiting some relatives. And, you know, I said, you know, I'm calling for a reason. I said, I'm been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And part of my program of recovery is to clean up my past. And I wanted to call you and tell you that I'm sorry that I shut you out of my life all these years. And he had been in another 12-step program for 14 years. And he knew exactly what I was doing. And we had the most amazing conversation. And from that point forward, I stayed in touch with him. I mean, he's 80. And I called him I talked to him every couple weeks. And last September, I was privileged enough to go to Washington, D.C. for a conference for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he lives in Quantico, Virginia. And he came up in his dilapidated old car and picked me up, and we went out to lunch. And it was like the best day of our lives. It meant so much to him that I came. And, two things. I didn't know that I could mean that much to somebody else, but to be able to show up for somebody else was really healing. And it's God. It's totally God. So I've done lots of amends, but that was like a big one. And someone from the conference asked me to share it with you. So there it is. Thanks.
Thank you to the panelists and all who shared. We will now close the meeting. The group conscience at the Fellowship of the Spirit Conference does not close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Instead, we encourage the entire conference to be treated with an attitude of continuous prayer, and we will then say the Lord's Prayer together at the close of the conference on Sunday. Please help me close this meeting by joining hands for a moment of silence. Let us share our spiritual experience and strength with each other so we may grow together in a greater understanding and love. Thank you.